It's my great pleasure to welcome you to the LSE Literary Festival and to tonight's panel on Yuval Levin's book, The Fractured Republic, Renewing America's Social Contract in the Age of Individualism. My name's Peter Tribowitz. I teach in the International Relations Department and head up LSE's U.S. Center, which is sponsoring tonight's event. So here we are, marking the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. Who would have thought that we would be doing so at a time when mainstream writers in the United States, like David Remnick of The New Yorker, would be drawing dark parallels between an American president's treatment of the free press and Lenin's assault on the enemies of the people in Pravda in 1917. But folks, that's where we are. America's being tested in ways that few observers thought possible a year ago, and in many ways, Yuval Levin's book provides an opportunity for us to reflect on what's happening in America, maybe even to get a little nostalgic, and to consider the political possibilities moving forward. Let me say a few words about tonight's panelists before we get down to business. Yuval Levin is the founding editor of the policy journal National Affairs. He's also the Hertog Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a senior editor of The New Atlantis, and a contributing editor to The National Review and The Weekly Standard. He's the author of four books on political thought and public policy. He received his doctorate from the University of Chicago from their Committee on Social Thought. He's written a lot about politics, but he's also practiced. He's worked in the White House on domestic policy during George W. Bush's administration, and before that as a congressional staffer on Capitol Hill. We're very, very pleased to have him here at the LSE this evening. We're also delighted to be joined by two of LSE's very own, Cheryl Schoenhardt Bailey and Michael McQuarrie. Cheryl is professor of government specializing in political economy, legislative politics, and text analysis. She's the author of several books, including most recently Deliberating Monetary Policy, as well as numerous articles in prestigious academic journals. In her spare time, Cheryl serves as the deputy head of the Department of Government. Michael McQuarrie is associate professor of sociology, where he writes and teaches about political sociology, urban politics, and social movements. His work has been published in Politics and Society, Public Culture, City and Community, among others. He's also the author of the most widely cited opinion piece on the U.S. Center blog, an entry on Trump and the revolt of the Rust Belt. Former labor and community organizer, Michael has held fellowships at the University of California and New York University. He's currently working on a book entitled Community Builders. So you can see we've got quite a lineup. My job basically tonight is to keep the time. So here's the schedule. We're going to give Yuval all of 20 minutes to summarize the argument in his book. Cheryl and Michael, I guess Michael will go first, then Cheryl will each have 10 minutes each to basically work Yuval over. And then what we'll do is open it up to questions from the audience, and I'll do my level best to get as many questions in as possible with the time that we have to work. I'll probably end up grouping questions, taking them in clusters. And let me also just mention before I forget that Yuval will be signing copies of his book after we conclude here, right outside in the lobby area. If you haven't already put your phones on silent, please do. This is being recorded. For those of you who are hoping to make contact with Mr. Trump tonight, the suggested hashtag is LSE Lit Fest. And with that, please join me in welcoming Yuval Levin and the panel.
Thank you very much, Peter, and thanks to LSE, to the U.S. Center, to all of you for being here. I appreciate the opportunity. If nothing else, just the opportunity to get out of Washington just now is very much appreciated. I'll give you a general overview and then more or less see what interests you. The book is really about, or at least it begins from, the intense frustration that has been overwhelming American politics for some time, and I think has a lot to do not only with the results of the last election and really with what may follow now, but with the general sense, the general tenor of American political life since the beginning of the 20th century, of the 21st century. Really, the period since the 21st century began has been a very uneasy time in U.S. politics. That's been reflected in the sorts of candidates that have risen up, but really in the volume and the style of our debates, in the kinds of concerns you hear expressed. Listening to political conversations at this point in America, you'd have to conclude that the United States is deeply frustrated. Now, at first glance, that kind of unhappiness or anxiety or frustration might seem pretty easy to explain. Again, before the election, not just after. The economy has been sluggish in some respects since the century began, and not only during the Great Recession of 2007 and 8. The century also began with the worst terrorist attack in American history, and things have not gotten all that much more stable since then, shattering the hope that people might have had for a peaceful post-Cold War world. Partisan politics in the U.S. have been intensely polarized and divisive in this period. Our cultural battles about very sensitive subjects, from stem cells to marriage and sexuality to religious liberty to national identity, have been fought at a fever pitch for these 15 years that's left a lot of people on all sides feeling besieged and offended. And some key indicators that cross economics and politics and culture, like family breakdown and inequality, have been pointing in the wrong direction for some time and standing in the way of mobility and of solidarity. So in a sense, the opening years of the 21st century have given Americans real reasons to worry, but there's also plainly been more to the frustration of this period than a straightforward response to challenging circumstances. We've been frustrated, too, at the apparent inability of our leaders and our politics to confront these challenges, or really even to acknowledge them in some respects. Some of that inability, that unwillingness to face reality, has just been a reflection of the willful blindness of many of us voters and citizens in America that's been reflected in our politics and in what our leaders have had to say. But some of it has also been a particular kind of escapism and denial among the leadership class in both parties. I want to say a brief word about each of those. The blindness of voters that's often reflected by our leaders has expressed itself maybe above all in a tendency to respond to contemporary problems with nostalgia, with a sense that what's wrong now is that America has changed from how it used to be and that solutions are to be found by going backward. That nostalgia really overwhelms American politics now. If you stand back and listen to what's being talked about, it's a very striking thing in both parties. I'll give you an example that I think will strike you as very familiar if you follow American politics, not because you've heard this particular statement before, but because you would hear something like it all the time. So here is a quote from a speech by an American politician. Quote, "Many people watching tonight can probably remember a time when finding a good job meant showing up at a nearby factory or a business downtown. You didn't always need a degree. Your competition was pretty much limited to your neighbors. If you worked hard, chances are you'd have a job for life with a decent paycheck and good benefits. Maybe you'd even have the pride of seeing your kids work at the same company. That world has changed, and for many, that change has been painful." That's President Obama in a speech before Congress a few years ago, but it could easily be pretty much any politician in either party now. We know it's not Donald Trump only because it's all in complete sentences. But it could very easily have been Trump. It's very much the kind of sentiment that he expresses. He also longs for an America of firm and stable industrial employment before, as he sees it, foreign competition took all that away. When the New York Times asked Trump in April of last year when America was last great, He stumbled around a bit and ended up in the late 1950s as an answer. And it's not just Trump who thinks that way. With a bit more of an emphasis on the cultural cohesion and stronger families of that post-war America, these lines could have easily come from a Mitt Romney speech or from most conservatives in American politics. With more explicit emphasis on the low inequality of that time, it could have been Hillary Clinton or Elizabeth Warren. America just isn't what it used to be. That's a key theme of contemporary American politics. And it speaks to a public anxiety that often comes down to a question asked in anguish. What has happened to our country? And of course, in a sense, it's not a bad question. Something big and significant certainly has happened to America. And in its less cartoonish forms, today's nostalgia is understandable. The America that our exhausted, wistful politics misses so much, the nation as it first emerged from the Great Depression and the Second World War and gradually evolved from there, was exceptionally unified and cohesive. It had at first an extraordinary confidence in large institutions, big government, big labor, big business, working together to address the nation's needs. America's cultural life at mid-century was not much less consolidated. It was dominated by a broad traditionalist moral consensus, at least on the surface. Religious attendance was at a peak. Families were strong. Birth rates were high. Divorce rates were low. And in the wake of a war in which most of its competitors had burned each other's economies to the ground, the United States dominated the world economy for a time, offering economic opportunity to workers of all kinds, high skill and mid skill and low skill. At least for whites in America, which is no small caveat, obviously, that time really was exceptional. But almost immediately after the war, that consolidated nation began a long process of unwinding and fragmenting. Over the subsequent decades, the culture liberalized and diversified as struggles against racism and sexism coincided with an enormous increase in immigration. Meanwhile, some key parts of the economy were deregulated to keep up with rising competitors, and the labor market was forced by globalizing pressures to specialize increasingly in higher skill work. In politics, too, an exceptional mid-century consensus on some key issues gave way by the 1970s to renewed divisions that have only gotten sharper and more polarized. In one arena after another, America in the immediate post-war years was a model of consolidation and consensus. But through the following decades, that consensus fractured. By the end of the 20th century, that fracturing had grown from diffusion into polarization. Polarization not only of political views, but of economic opportunities, of incomes, of family patterns, of ways of life. We've grown less conformist but more fragmented, more diverse but less unified, more dynamic but less secure. All of that has certainly meant many gains for America in some important respects, in national prosperity, in personal liberty, in cultural diversity, in technological progress, in social justice, and just in options and choices in every realm of life. But over time, it's also meant a loss of faith in institutions, a loss of social order and structure, a loss of national cohesion, a loss of security and stability for many workers, a loss of cultural and political consensus. And those losses have piled up in ways that now often seem to many Americans to overwhelm the gains and have made our 21st century politics distinctly backward-looking and morose. Conservatives and progressives have emphasized different facets of these changes. Progressives treasure the social liberation, the growing cultural diversity of the past half century, but lament the economic dislocation, the loss of social solidarity, the rise of inequality. Conservatives celebrate the economic liberalization, the greater dynamism, but lament the social instability, the moral disorder, the cultural breakdown, the weakening of fundamental institutions and traditions. But these changes are all tied together. The liberalization that the left celebrates is the fragmentation that the right laments, and vice versa. That set of forces, liberalizing and fragmenting, diversifying and fracturing, are all functions of the essential driving force of American life since the end of the Second World War, what we might very generally and in broad terms describe as individualism. In the first half of the 20th century, up through the Second World War, America saw an age of growing consolidation and cohesion. As the economy industrialized, government grew more centralized, the culture became more aggregated through mass media, and national identity and cohesion were often valued above individuality and diversity. In those years, many of the most powerful forces in American life were pushing each American to become more like everyone else, and the nation that emerged from the Second World War was therefore highly and exceptionally cohesive. The second half of the 20th century and these opening decades of the 21st then marked an age of growing deconsolidation and decentralization. As the culture became increasingly variegated and diverse, the economy gradually diversified and in some respects deregulated, and individualism and personal identity came to be held up above conformity and national unity. In these years, many of those same forces have been pushing each American to become not more like everyone else, but more like himself or herself. Mid-20th century America, especially that period of the 1950s and the early 60s, in a sense stood between these two distinguishable periods, and for a time could keep one foot in each of them, combining dynamism with cohesion to an extraordinary degree. That kind of straggling of the two really was a wonder to behold. It's not surprising that many Americans idolize that time and miss it. It offered a stable, cohesive backdrop for different forms of liberalization, be it cultural or economic. But that liberalization has now done its work, and today's America is its result. It's a highly individualistic, diverse, fragmented society, economically, politically, and culturally. And none of that is about to be undone, so that Americans will have to solve the problems that we face as such a society. Both our strengths and our weaknesses are functions of this path we've traveled together, and we'll now have to draw on those strengths to address those weaknesses. That's one way to think about what has happened to our country. It's, in a sense, the essential challenge of the politics of 21st century America, how to use the advantages of a diverse, dynamic society to address the disadvantages of a fractured, insecure society. But if that doesn't sound like the question that American politics is asking itself, it's because it isn't. The country's political culture has not been very good at grasping either the challenges we face or the strengths that we possess to face them. It's instead been overwhelmed by nostalgia, by a desire to reverse the process of liberalization or diffusion, whether in economic terms or in cultural terms, to recreate a more consolidated consensus. The first step toward a constructive 21st century politics would have to be to see that such a reversal is not an option, and that we probably wouldn't really want it anyway. Instead, Americans have to think about how to address the challenges of dissolution and diffusion, challenges like the breakdown of the family, like the loss of worker security and growing polarization and inequality, by making the most of strengths like diversity and dynamism and specialization. We have to look forward. But the second facet of the failure of our political system to confront reality has a lot to do with a failure to look forward properly, or rather with an unwillingness among some of America's leaders to acknowledge that their cherished vision of the future may not really be what the future looks like. That cherished vision is a function in many respects of an attempt to make sense of the post-Cold War world by emphasizing the best facets of the liberalization or diffusion that I've just described. In the 1990s in particular, elites of both the right and left in the United States and around the West came to believe that the end of the Cold War would bring about an era of liberal peace. For America's intellectual and political leaders, that raised the possibility of making the most of the advantages made possible by our decades of liberalization while overcoming or really ignoring the disadvantages so that market dynamism could simply coexist with cultural diversity. And the question was how to spread the bounty of both. A casual observer of the 2000 presidential election between Al Gore and George W. Bush might have imagined that America's two major parties had found fairly plausible left and right-wing paths for doing just that. The campaign was an argument about how to govern after the end of history. Read George W. Bush's first State of the Union address to Congress in February of 2001, and you'll find yourself in an alternate universe. As Bush put it, America had, quote, a balanced budget, big surpluses, peace with our neighbors. The question is how not to waste these opportunities. Just a year later, in his second State of the Union address to Congress, in January of 2002, the world had changed dramatically. The September 11th attacks launched an era of insecurity and chaos. A recession had taken hold, too, and the foundations of America's common life seemed a lot shakier. History had refused to end. We couldn't quite perceive it then, but that dark turn should have marked the end of the illusions of the 1990s. The illusion especially shared in common by many in the West that the process of liberalization and the growing diversity of our societies combined with the end of the Cold War would finally mean the triumph of progressive liberal democracy around the world. In fact, that's not what the progress of liberalization and fracture ended up making possible. It's not what the end of the Cold War ended up making possible. Instead, they brought the resurgence of long submerged forces, nationalism and populism, ethnic tensions and economic resentments. These would be the challenges of the post-Cold War world. These are the challenges that torment the West in the early 21st century. And to this day, our leaders have not figured out how to govern amid the actual realities of this era. Global instability and rising threats, weak growth at home, yielding economic insecurity for many people, and the continuing fracturing and fragmentation of our major institutions. Political elites throughout the developed world have made the mistake of treating problems like these as threats to the dream of governing at the end of history, rather than as threats to the physical and social and cultural and economic security of their particular citizens. 15 years after the dream of governing at the end of history should have been shattered, the best that the two-party elites in America could come up with was running George W. Bush's brother against Bill Clinton's wife for president. The two of them perfectly embodied the widespread, if implicit, wish that it could be 2001 again, just one more time. They reeked of the past, or at least of the past's way of imagining the future, and they both seemed disoriented by the world that they were suddenly, horribly forced to inhabit. That drift, that at times really outright contempt by some of their leaders, combined with a long escalating loss of faith in institutions, has left a lot of voters in America increasingly frustrated and angry. And what Donald Trump seemed to grasp in 2016 was that the unwillingness of leaders in both parties even to acknowledge these problems had created an enormous opportunity to appeal to frustrated voters simply by acknowledging their frustration, even without really offering ways to address it. Trump's diagnoses were always more important to his appeal than his prescriptions, which even Trump's supporters never really seemed to take seriously. He had grasped something about what decades of fracture had done to America's political culture. He saw that by 2016, alienation was an enormously powerful political force in our country, and that identifying with alienated voters could matter even more than offering concrete answers to their worries. That appeal was certainly mixed for some Trump voters with a powerful sense of loss, which is not the same as alienation. Trump's appeal to American greatness struck a patriotic nerve among some of his supporters and was certainly received in some quarters as a much-needed call to restore America's dignity and strength. In that respect, it appealed to some sentiments and to some voters frequently drawn to conservative politics in America. But what was new about Trump's appeal, I think, and what ultimately seemed most powerful about it, had more to do with a kind of resentment that formed only a very partial response to the character of liberalism in our time. He tended to translate voters' sense of loss into a further sense of alienation, and so to exacerbate the problems that had created an opening for him. Alienation can sometimes make for a powerful organizing principle for an electoral coalition, especially when hostility overpowers apathy among the sentiments that it breeds. But alienation doesn't make for a natural organizing principle for a governing coalition. The sense of lacking a stake in the nation's governing institutions, the feeling that those institutions are remote and unresponsive, makes it difficult to know what to do when they fall into your position, into your possession. And so the question of how the forces that brought Trump to power will shape his use of that power very much remains open as Trump's term in office begins. It's not simply or entirely open, though, because alienation was not the last word on what the course of the 2016 election might teach us about our fractured republic in America. It's joined by a subtle but powerful yearning for solidarity that points in more constructive directions and that really stands to transform America's political life. And this, too, I think, is clearer in light of the past year. It certainly didn't always feel like the last election was about solidarity. It was a terribly divisive election, more so than usual, and it sharpened the peculiar condition of American politics, which combines intense partisanship with very weak parties. But near the core of those divisions really was a difference of opinion about how to unify the country. Voters were very dissatisfied. Bernie Sanders won about 43% of the Democratic vote in the primaries. Donald Trump won about 45% of the Republican vote, won the nomination and eventually the presidency. But voters in both parties clearly were not happy with the status quo, and we can learn something, I think, from the way in which they were not happy. On the left, voters seemed dissatisfied with the Democratic Party's inclination to cast their needs and interests and identities as just further excuses for the same old neoliberal economic tinkering. On the right, voters were dissatisfied with the rote sloganeering conservatism of a lot of the Republican Party, which repeated the ends of Ronald Reagan's sentences but had long ago forgotten how they started. In both cases, abstractions about freedom and prosperity seemed much less satisfying than they used to, while gestures in the direction of solidarity were deeply compelling, even when they were not fully worked out. Because they weren't fully worked out, those kinds of gestures could take dark and brutish forms, and they often did. But they were about how to unify the country and be stronger together. On the right, the general idea seemed to be, at least for Trump, that by building walls around our country, we might be able to break down walls within our country. A revival of nationalism, he implied, could be a unifying force that works by excluding outsiders to include all insiders, and so offering us a means to define all of us as one. On the left, the quest for solidarity is pointed toward the argument that our society is divided only in the ways in which human individuals in general are divided, by gender, by race, by ethnicity and identity, and that we can unite despite these divisions by recognizing that we're all human beings, but also acknowledging the value and importance of these differences. This plays down our national identity while playing up our personal identity in the hope that it might offer a more inclusive path to unity. And it means, among other things, that the boundaries between Americans and non-Americans should be fairly porous so that our humanity shines through. One problem with the left's approach is that it imposes a kind of soft relativism on the culture as a whole, yet does so with real coercive force against traditionalists who are reticent to accept it. And coercive relativism tends to be both incoherent and unsatisfying. A key problem with the right's approach is that unity pursued by exclusion almost unavoidably becomes divisive and ugly, and it can also seem inviting to people whose desire for a purified unity expresses itself in ethnic or in racial terms. But the fact that both the left and right seem eager for solidarity, that American politics is bitterly divided about how to be more unified, is worth understanding and is by no means all bad. These shifting emphases of our two broad political coalitions suggest an underlying shift in our common life from an American politics that expresses above all a yearning for freedom to one that, at least alongside that, expresses once again a powerful yearning for solidarity. And the experience of fracture, of the division, the loneliness, and alienation that result from it is surely near the root of that growing desire and might help further define the challenge that confronts American politics today. So that challenge, in closing, roughly stated, is how can our diverse, dynamic society in America address the problems of fragmentation and fracture in ways that contribute to greater national unity? What we require, it seems to me, is a political vision, a governing agenda geared to filling the vacuums that Trump's success made apparent. His success didn't point toward many solutions to this problem, but it certainly emphasized the problem. The need for means of addressing challenges that combine material want and moral emptiness, the need to help people both meet their needs and be more needed, to combat despair and disillusionment by reviving some genuine sources of moral authority and reaffirming the case for both personal and mutual responsibility. We need to fight alienation by putting power a little closer to the interpersonal level and making the social order seem a little less distant. We need to pursue greater unity by means that are suited to the particular forms of our diversity. Now, public policy can't do all of this, obviously, but it can help. And for one thing, using our diversity and fragmentation as a tool of problem solving would require an approach to governing that empowers problem solvers throughout American society, rather than hoping that just one in Washington will get things right. That means bringing to public policy the kind of dispersed, incremental, bottom-up approaches to progress that increasingly pervade every other part of American life. An approach that lets authority flow through our mediating institutions, and it solves problems by giving people options and letting their choices matter. This more distributed, decentralized vision of problem solving is how the modern post-industrial economy tends to work. It's also the logic of federalism embodied in America's constitutional order, and the logic of subsidiarity articulated by the best traditions of our civilization. And it should speak to both the right and the left in different ways. Over the past decade and more, ideas rooted in this kind of vision have been developed and refined by some generally younger policy-minded conservatives in Washington. From healthcare to education to welfare to taxation regulation, across the full spectrum of domestic affairs, they've worked to turn this vision into substantive policy proposals. They share some of the frustration and concerns that animated Trump's appeal, but not the alienation or despair. They want to appeal to people's aspirations as much as their worries. This is why, to my mind, although Trump's success in 2016 certainly suggests that the right in America is becoming less conservative, the frustrations and needs that made his victory possible suggest the need for a resurgence of conservatism. That resurgence would have to understand itself as much as a civic endeavor as a political one. A similarly decentralized and community-oriented progressivism is also imaginable in America. It might come a little less naturally at first to today's left, but they have a rich tradition of progressive localism and community and labor organizing to draw on. Their thinking can be aided by an enormous intellectual and practical tradition. Michael's work can show them the way, among others. And surely decentralization and federalism should have some appeal for progressives now in particular, since centralized national power means power in the hands of Donald Trump and congressional Republicans. Decentralization can help public policy to combat some of the specific difficulties that face Americans in this era by enabling experimentation, not only with welfare and wage supports, but with different forms of labor law and worker organizing, and by encouraging competition in higher education and skills training, it may be possible to create some new opportunities. Decentralization might easily seem, of course, like a force for more fragmentation, more division, not more unity. But I think that would be true if the alternative were a cohesive and consolidated polity, because the real alternative in the lives of many Americans today is actually isolation and radical individualism. A more decentralized politics might work to draw people out of their narrow circles and into the public arena, toward a common space where Americans can see each other face to face, where not every question has to be an all or nothing fight in Washington. So subsidiarity, federalism, or decentralization could be a focal point for an agenda of renewal, and given the sorry shape of national politics in America, should appeal to all parties. By beginning a little closer to the ground, we could start to focus again on what holds us together. Champions of localism or subsidiarity in America, as in Britain, love to cite Edmund Burke's reference to the little platoons that make up a society. But we would be wise, I think, to remember the context in which that line arises for Burke. It's not a case for fragmentation, but exactly for unity. To be attached to the subdivision, to love the little platoon we belong to in society, Burke wrote, is the first principle, the germ, as it were, of public affections. It is the first link in the series by which we proceed toward a love of our country and to mankind. That first link is broken, and a love of country, even of mankind, seems in awfully short supply in American political life these days. And given the particular shape of our problems, it seems to me that we might begin to replenish that love by taking on more problems where they're found and thinking about politics a little more from the bottom up. The past year has made the need for that kind of approach to politics and policy more clear, but it has not made its success more likely. Our work is very much cut out for us in America. The country is frustrated and anxious, and therefore having trouble seeing past its troubles and its strengths to opportunities. We're witnessing, I think, the exhaustion of an old political order, but not yet the rise of a new one. That's part of what it means to watch two 70-year-olds run against each other for president. To see the way forward, we have to open our eyes to America's 21st century circumstances, to grasp both the challenges and the opportunities they represent, and to see how, again, applying some enduring principles to novel circumstances could be the recipe for a real revival. That, it seems to me, is where any hope of revival might be rooted in America. And to the extent that our contemporary problems have some parallels here in Britain, I hope that maybe a few reflections on that front might help you think about some of your own challenges. And in any case, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to offer those few reflections, and thank you for the invitation.
Hi, I'm Michael McQuarrie. So a few thoughts on Yuval's book and his talk. The first thing that I'll say is that the talk was what I wish the book had been.
20 minutes long.
Maybe the next one. In that, some questions that I had about the book were answered more directly or even differently in this talk than I think they were in the book. And I'll explain a little bit about why I feel that way. I'm very sympathetic to what Yuval's trying to accomplish in his book. He is seeking political renewal, and he's seeking it not through partisanship. He's seeking it not through the ideologies that dominate party politics, which, as he points out, are really quite exhausted. They're exhausted on both the left and the right. And, you know, one of the effects of this is something that Yuval actually gives a very nice dissection of, which is nostalgia and the way that it's dominating political discussion in the United States. When everybody's being nostalgic, it means people aren't coming up with good new ideas. And it reminds me of the conservative critical theorist Christopher Lash, who wrote in the 1980s a book on the idea of progress in American political thought. And it's an amazing dissection of the way progress sort of dominated political thinking for 100 years in the United States. And what Yuval has offered in his book is sort of what happens when the progress narrative dies and it's replaced with a nostalgic narrative. And, you know, as such, it really is, it's a basic way we narrate ourselves that we need to grapple with. Another thing that I'm very attracted to is the idea of a Tocquevillian renaissance. I'm enough of an American to buy Tocqueville's line about American exceptionalism, which is basically that the state was not strong enough to basically replace citizen organizations, citizen autonomy in building the nation. And as a result, we've had a more decentralized, democratic disposition in the United States, which Tocqueville, I read him as finding all of that all very boring. He was an aristocrat, and I think his whole time in the United States, he was more or less looking for a good dinner party and never found one, because Americans were boring. They were always talking about, you know, the roads they were building and stuff instead of exciting things that were happening in intellectual life or politics or exceptional acts of human endeavor. That really wasn't what Americans were concerned with. So Tocqueville was interested, but he was bored. But, you know, he's also a guy whose family, members of his family had their heads cut off during the French Revolution, so he's very interested in this idea of how democracy can actually function without heads rolling, literally. And he saw in America something that was truly exceptional given the European experience. Okay. So we have this idea of the Tocquevillian renewal, and Yuval goes into some details about this, and it seems to me that one of the main things that he's really pursuing here is the idea of relationality. Like Tocqueville, Yuval diagnoses individualism as being one of the main problems in American society. So it's a cultural diffusion and atomization that he sees as one of the main problems here. This was key to Tocqueville's understanding. Tocqueville actually didn't think it was necessarily bad. He thought that the way that American civic institutions work, they actually leveraged individualism quite well, the idea of self-interest rightly understood that Tocqueville often talked about. So people were still interested, they were still rational, but they weren't a very specific American way that was cultivated in civic associations. And he wants this kind of relationality to sort of replace mediation through, I assume, transactions or media, other things like this that prevent us from relating to one another directly, forming values, creating institutions, and so on. This, however, I'm not so sure how well this actually applies to a diagnosis of American society. Sociology in general is founded on the idea that there's a zero-sum game between community and modernization. And this idea dominates classical sociological thinking, not just Tocqueville, but Tunis, Weber, Marx, all of these people have this idea. They have varying opinions about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but they all see this as the main division. But I'm not so sure that that actually really does apply. It was core to the Frankfurt School thinking about what was the problem with mass society, that we were all atomized and alienated and so on like that. There are reasons to think that this is important, but it also seemed too unidirectional and too historical to me. And I think that we need to think about less about this sort of zero-sum game and more about the ways that these things can coexist. Another way that this plays out is a zero-sum game that is often seen, including in Yuval's book, between the state and mediating institutions. The state, in Yuval's telling, is a social democratic state which appropriates the functions of civic organizations and therefore leaves nothing but individuals out there in the landscape outside of Washington, D.C., alienated individuals, atomized individuals that are not relating to one another, and so on. This strikes me as a more or less contrived picture of the American civic landscape throughout much of modern history. So Josh Pasevich, who's a sociologist who writes about states and civic institutions, just wrote a book about Iowa and politics in Iowa. And he's basically giving a diagnosis of why Iowans suddenly flipped from voting Democrat, Obama, and now voting for Trump. And what he finds, actually, is some of what Yuval's talking about. He finds alienation. He finds atomization. But it's not because of government. In fact, what he argues is that American welfare institutions operated in a way that actually cultivated localism. Money and resources were often distributed to localities, and in localities, people would decide together how they should be distributed. Local business associations and labor unions were often the main players in arbitrating these. These are civic institutions. They're Tocquevillian institutions, and they're mediating institutions. They've been destroyed not because of the welfare state. They've been destroyed by retrenchment. Without any money going there anymore, you have competitive grants being distributed to localities, and the one prime driver for getting these grants is to show community unanimity. That has had the effect of undermining the civic institutions that actually organize people's preferences in a lot of Iowa towns. And as a result, what you get is the only way that people can connect to national politics is through ideology and cable news. Well, if you're only connecting to people to politics or ideology and cable news, you're going to be subject to the kind of partisanship, the kind of scaremongering and fearmongering that we've seen in the last election. Okay. So that's against that zero-sum game. But this can be fleshed out in any number of ways. I mean, the idea that that our governance in the United States is organized around centralizing principles, there are examples of that, but they're not that many of those examples. So there's already been one big Tocquevillian revival in American governance, and that occurred in the 1980s. And one of the ways that that Reagan Republicans and Democrats could find a way forward in social policy was actually an agreement that we will provide social provision, but we will only provide it through markets and civic associations. And so all kinds of laws that were being passed in that period actually took this sort of idea very much on board. We build low-income housing now, basically through markets and civic associations, not through federal government, not even through local government. Local government is an arbiter of land, and that's about it. We distribute educational innovation funding that way. So we've already been through cycles of this, and I don't see very much of that in the book, and I don't see very much awareness of this on Yuval's part, which makes me think that this is still being driven by a partisan motivation, which makes it hard for me to really understand where all of this is leading. So, you know, American governance is probably more Tocquevillian than Yuval lets on, and, you know, this is... this, you know, from an American perspective, it's hard to see that. And I'll forgive him for that. He's an American. But if you've had a family member cared for example, by the NHS, well, it's really easy to see the virtues of American Tocquevillian governance. I would much rather my wife be cared for in an American healthcare system than a British one. And the British one is more centralized. That perspective is something that perhaps I've gained from moving to the UK and having a sick spouse. That is something that I think we should keep in mind. All right. So with that, I have a couple of questions for Yuval, just as a way of sparking discussion. So Yuval is opening the door to a right-wing accommodation of multiculturalism, which is a very interesting argument. And he has a very nice quote in there about how multiculturalism may be the last defense for Christian conservatives in a multicultural society. So their values are under threat. They feel under attack. But defending them on the grounds of multiculturalism seems like a way of defending that territory in a multicultural logic. I think that's very interesting. But I'm wondering if there's an overall account of multiculturalism that would, for example, include Black Lives Matter and Campaign Zero equally alongside Christian conservatives. In terms of mediating institutions, I ask the same thing, which is, do we have an overall account of the value of mediating institutions, or are they the mediating institutions that conservatives like? Conservatives have attacked two very important mediating institutions over the last couple of years. A right-wing hack attack was done on the community organization ACORN a couple years ago, the result was basically the destruction of that organization. Well, that was a mediating organization, and it was destroyed through partisan politics. Now, in a way, that's an example of what Yuval thinks is bad, but I'm also wondering if his interest in and defense of mediating institutions would extend to an organization like ACORN. The second is Planned Parenthood, which, of course, has been on the block for several years, but is another mediating institution that reflects the values of many Americans, but is also very much in conflict with the values of Christian conservatives. And we will see what happens to Planned Parenthood soon. The Obama administration's worked very hard to defend it, and I'm sure that others will work very hard to undermine it. But this is also a mediating institution, and as such, it would seem to warrant defense. So I'll just summarize by saying that that Yuval's call for localism and mediating institutions is very welcome, especially in a context where what we've seen in the last election is a sectional revolt, a renewal of sectional politics in American presidential elections, and one which is heavily overdetermined by the demise of communities and, in particular, the institutions that once sustained them. Now, given that, it seems like this is very much warranted. But the one other thing that I will flag about this is that there's often, in all the discussions about Tocqueville and the importance of civil society, one of the main lines of debate has been the role of markets. And Yuval mostly presents markets as a distributive mechanism, which is neutral. The problem is government, not markets. But the place that revolt is a place that is hard to argue that has actually been destroyed by government. This is a part of the world, the industrial Midwest, which has basically been wiped out by free trade. People couldn't compete effectively in a global context, and the jobs that they had were lost as a result. Then it was they lost their pensions in a stock market bubble, which result from market liberalization and finance. And finally, they were wiped out. Their last asset was wiped out in the foreclosure crisis, which was a direct result of market deregulation in mortgage finance. So you've seen communities that have been serially wiped out by these by market action and by the effects of marketizing or commodifying certain elements of our society. And for mediating institutions to be able to carry the weight that Yuval wants them to, they have to have some way of dealing with markets. And I will leave it there. Thanks.
Okay, so I'm the only one standing between you and the opportunity to ask your questions, and you've been very patient. So I'll try to keep the comments reasonably succinct, if I can, so watch the time. So I have a few initial remarks just based on what we've heard so far, and then I have some other more systematic remarks. So one is, I was reflecting Michael's discussion about localism and some of the issues, and I was thinking of this anecdote that I'm originally from Idaho, and my family has a cabin in the mountains of Idaho in a very small town, well, near a small town, called New Meadows, population 500 on a good day. Now, New Meadows is a quintessential example of localism that got it wrong, because you have a small N in the town hall led by one, two individuals who happen to have perhaps some personality problems, and think about nostalgia in a very big way. Nothing must change in this community. Nothing. Nothing. No new roads. No new buildings. No new sewers. No nothing. So the rest of the community throws up their hands and says, well, we just have to wait till she dies, and then we'll get progress. So I worry a little bit about localism and the small n problem when you have localism. But, okay, so I'm not a sociologist, and these are like big picture questions here. I'm also an empiricist, and this is not an empirical book. So I'm a political economist, and I like empirics. So I could have come at this with some comments about, you know, really, this is a problem of globalization, okay? And there are a lot of people out there who are scratching their heads and saying, well, you know, we thought up until quite recently, 2015, 2016, that globalization, for the most part, was a good thing, you know? Liberal international economic trade, neoclassical trade theory suggests that, you know, this would be a good thing. Back to David Ricardo, comparative advantage. And then we, and namely the elites, have cottoned on to the fact that maybe globalization does indeed have some perpetual losers. And these losers sometimes have a voice. And what do we do about that? Well, we've seen a lot of head scratching in that realm. So we think about actually what we're talking here is a political economy problem. We're talking about the effects of globalization, making America economically, culturally, socially more vulnerable. And what we're seeing are the consequences of that, right? So the kind of remedies might be different remedies than looking at the social dimension. But I'm not going to do that. So I am going to try to do the uncomfortable thing for me and go with the flow here. Okay, so trying to kind of get into the vernacular of Yuval. So bear with me. This is going to go in a slightly strange direction, and it may or may not work. All right, so I read the book as focusing on this solution of, you know, revitalizing middle America, these, you know, these middle layers of American society. This all sounded, yeah, you know, a little bit kind of nirvana. Yeah, it sounds like a good thing, but who's going to do it? You know, like that lady in New Meadows who keeps stopping everything and we wait till she dies? Like, who's... You know, who are going to fight those sort of people? Who's going to step up to the plate here? And what's their motivation going to be? What's the common ethos that is going to underpin this revitalization? Now, I was reflecting on this, and I'll get to a point here, so bear with me. I was reflecting on this over the weekend. So I'd been reading the book last week, and on the weekend I went to... what happens to be a series of student documentaries by 16 to 19-year-olds. My son's a 16-year-old aspiring to be a film director. So these were short films, short documentaries. And one of them, I thought, wow, that actually really relates to this book. So it was a film called Culture Wars. And it was about UK society in this case, and about immigrants who'd come to the UK, a Russian guy and a lady from Afghanistan and so on and so forth. And these people were arguing about, you know, how they felt about leaving their own culture behind and how they felt about their own identity and so on. And the key spokesperson, I forgot where he was from, but anyway, he was arguing midway through the movie that the notion of home, meaning one's own national culture, was an illusion. And that the key was not to think about back home, perhaps in any nostalgic way, but about me, my identity, my self-fulfillment, who I am, right, as an immigrant in the UK, or in the UK, US, or wherever, right? So the argument was we should celebrate the diversity in having this sort of larger amalgamation of individuals, each individually rejoicing in their own identities. Then the film ended with a message of find your own home, and I thought, huh, right, that didn't really make sense, but it was a 16 to 19 year old film. But I came away from that thinking, okay, there's a story here about home and about a sense of belonging. I thought, okay, what is home? Is home an individual? You know, are we talking about individualism here? To my mind, I don't think so. I view home as a collectivity, a sort of a shared experience, a shared existence. More to the point, it's a shared existence with responsibilities, a shared existence with obligations to others. So you might be a unique member within that collectivity, but you're part of something bigger than yourself, and with that comes some responsibilities. So I was thinking, okay, well, if we think about this notion of home, what, you know, am I getting it right? Well, you know, so what is home? And I thought of this, and I didn't actually realize it was from a poem. I just remembered that there was this famous quote. I looked it up, good old Google, and it was from a Robert Frost poem. Now, I'm not into poetry at all, but anyway. So the poem is called The Death of the Hired Man. The quote is, home is the place where... when you have to go there, they have to take you in. So, now the context for this, and I didn't realize the context before, was this conversation between a farmer and his wife, and the farmer says this rather sarcastically when he's faced with an ex-employee who comes back to the farm looking for employment. And the farmer's really, you know, disgruntled. He really wants the guy to leave. But as it turns out, through the course of the poem, is that the employee has come back to the farm, back to the place that he considers home, in order to die. So it's a poem. It's a pretty powerful poem about responsibility, about obligation, about providing a home, even for the undeserved. It's also about a sense of belonging. Now, I would argue that it's this sense of innate responsibility and an obligation that is missing both from the individualism that Yuval depicts quite nicely in the book, but it's also missing from his solution. This revival of middle layers of American society lacks a motivation, to my mind, because to create the civic associations, the churches, the schools, and the so-ons and the so forth, they take work. They take people to step up to the plate and act, to become involved, to stand away from the lure of individualism. So the lure of individualism needs an alternative lure. Now, maybe this could be created in the form of some notion of community, a shared obligation, perhaps centered around the notion of home. Maybe. I'm not convinced. So I'll end where I began, on political economy. So the larger picture, when I was thinking of this dichotomy between individualism, the lure of individualism, versus stepping up to the plate, obligations to others, shared responsibilities, reminds me of the classic, and I'm sure it will be familiar to many of you here, Tragedy of the Commons, which is straight out of political economy. And maybe the Republic is the commons. So the question is, how do we solve the problem of free-riding individualism? Maybe it's a collective action problem. So maybe we're looking for solutions in the wrong place. I'll leave it at that.
Well, thanks. That's a terrific set of comments. We have a little less than a half an hour to work with. I suppose, Yuval, do you want to respond, or would you like me to take some questions and hold your response for a while?
I'm glad to leave it up to you. I can say a few words about each.
Why don't I give you a couple minutes, and then sure. We'll open it up.
Yeah. Sure. I thank you, first of all, to both of you for wonderful responses and wonderfully different responses, which also is always nice. I think, Michael, you want me to be a little more partisan than I am, which I appreciate. I'm really not an anti-government conservative, not in any fundamental way. And I'm a two-cheers-for-capitalism conservative. I certainly don't think the market is a magical solution for much. I think it just tends to be a more effective way to solve certain kinds of problems, but there's no question that a lot of the challenges that the United States and the West in general confront now are caused by some of the effects of capitalism. I mean, that seems clear enough, and I wouldn't dispute it at all. The question of how to think about solutions has to force us to also think about what role markets can play or should play or might play. But I certainly agree in a general way that they shouldn't be let off their responsibility. As for whether an account of mediating institutions can account for left and right, look, I don't think that we ought to be partisan in how we think about mediating institutions. The Planned Parenthood question is, of course, wrapped up in the abortion question in America, and the question now before the Congress and the new president is really whether this largest abortion provider in America should be receiving $500,000 a year. It's not exactly a question about mediating institutions, but it's related. It has to do with it. I agree with you. It's a properly political question. But in a sense, it seems to me that, I mean, really the argument I make is about finding a better balance. It's not a suggestion that turning to mediating institutions, empowering mediating institutions, is a magical solution to any of these problems. It's a matter of whether we lean too much in one direction or another. Politics in the United States is generally not fought out between absolute extremes. It's fought out within a fairly broadly shared set of assumptions. But I do think we're at a point where we incline too much in one direction at this point. We incline too much in the direction of a kind of radical individualism, that the left and right do it for their own reasons, and that they both ought to push back a little for their own reasons, and that those reasons are rather strong. So that I do think that there's a way in which our politics can become more healthy by doing this, but only more healthy. It's still going to be politics, and there's no denying the trouble with it. And to Cheryl, this is related. I wouldn't say that localism can be a panacea or that you can get away from the kinds of problems that arise. You know, the trouble with believing in civil society is that you then have to attend a lot of meetings and run into a lot of people. And, you know, there's a saying in America that you believe in federalism for as long as it takes you to get to Trenton, the capital of New Jersey. And then you realize that maybe the states are not the solution. The states are not the solution. It's not that things are just better at that level. It seems to me that the stronger argument is that by having a greater diversity of problem solvers trying to find solutions to the same kinds of problems, you're a little more likely to arrive at solutions that have a better chance to work. But it's all about a greater degree. It's not about a fundamentally different way of thinking about politics. I certainly agree American politics is, to a very great degree, already quite Tocquevillian. That's why I think it can work. It's not an invention from scratch.
Great. Okay, thank you. We'll start over here, the gentleman right back there.
Good evening. Thank you very much for three very stimulating talks. I'm Zach Paikin. I'm from the University of Kent. I'm a PhD candidate there in international relations. I had a question for Dr. Levin, and it has to do with the following. I mean, yes, indeed, civic life and national cohesion are very much about the importance of strong mediating institutions, but they're also naturally about strong national institutions and strong liberal democratic life. And I'm sure you've read David Frum's recent piece in The Atlantic on how to build an autocracy. And I was wondering that if in 4 years or in 8 years, if there is a massive expansion of the power of the executive, whether, and that sets a precedent, obviously, for the president that would come after President Trump, whether or not this would change any of your prescriptions, and how would it change them, if so?
Okay, we're going to take a couple questions. There's a question right in front. We'll go here, and then this gentleman back here in the black sweater. Can you just raise your hand? We'll go to you next. Okay. Go ahead.
Hello. I've been spending the last couple of years investigating and studying subsidiarity, and particularly David Cameron's Big Society. And you managed to summarize my research in one sentence. So thank you for that, how badly it's done in terms of mandating. My main question is, sometimes it seems to me that you spend a lot of time talking about trial and error and experimentation and problem solving, but who decides what are the problems? So this is one of my beefs with Putnam was that what if single mothers, motherhood is not a problem? What if the curriculum is not a problem? Like, who decides and how do we unpick solving things that aren't problems?
A question for Dr. Levin. Don't you think that decentralization is not going to work in the current media landscape where you have such polarization of technology on both sides? You have on the far right, you have sort of Alex Jones in InfoWars. On the other side, on the far left, you have David Brock in Media Matters. And they're all asking for big ticket national policy, public policy solutions to their problems. And if you're asking them for temper expectations right now, what's going to happen is that local issues become national debates all the time in a world of 24/7 news media and social media. And don't you think also that you need to have a basic sort of social democratic foundation to have this sort of civic participation? So if you look at the Scandinavian countries, which have the highest rankings on social capital, they also tend to have sort of basic healthcare, universal healthcare, free education. If you don't have this kind of basic felt needs, you can't have this kind of organizing spirit locally.
Okay. So, well, all three of these have been directed at you, but the floor is open here. So why don't you go ahead and take the first crack?
All right, I'll start. David Frum is a good friend, and I've had this argument with him, so I'm happy to have it again. I am very much not a Trump supporter, as you might have guessed, but I don't think that the threat of Donald Trump is the threat of autocracy. I don't think that he's going to be competent enough to pull off anything like that. I mean it seriously. I think the threat is a threat of enormous dysfunction in the center of the American political system. The system, at least as it's developed for half a century and more, assumes a very competent president and is going to work very badly without one. I think we're already seeing that. I mean, if you look at the past month, and really, the hardest thing to believe in Washington is that Trump has only been president for 4 weeks. But if you look at these 4 weeks, I don't think what we're seeing is the formation of an autocracy. I think what we're seeing is the breakdown of basic order in the executive branch of government. I actually tend to think that's more likely to be the danger. But in a sense, either way, it seems to me that a president with whom many people are unhappy stands as an argument for devolving power where that's possible. So that you are finding, I think, more people on the left in America having newly rediscovered the appeal of federalism and decentralization. And that's natural. That happens. But it seems to me that people on the right who really believe this, rather than just believed it while Barack Obama was president, should take that as an opportunity and should try to look for ways where that can be done. Shall I work through the questions or?
Go ahead.
Well, so on who decides, it's a great question. It's the question. I think we ought to incline where it's possible to allow the people who face a problem to decide what looks to them like a solution. Now, that's much easier said than done, but that's what it means to allow for social welfare policy and social policy in general to be about providing people with choices so that it is parents who decide what school is working better, so that it is patients who decide what kinds of healthcare options make more sense. To the extent possible, the power to decide what's working should be in the hands of the people who need something to work better for them. That's a general organizing principle. It is by no means always possible in actual public policy. But I think we should incline toward that answer where it's available. And on the final question, also an excellent question, I think there's two ways to think about the media and decentralization. The media environment today is fragmented. There are lots and lots of options. And so that doesn't necessarily argue for a greater centralization of our political life. As you say, what it means is that everybody is free to argue about national politics. That's true. But I think it can also mean that there are other avenues for arguing about politics in different ways. You know, conservatives all the time in America complain about the press. I mean, this is the new president's full-time job, apparently. And this is a strange time, really, to complain about the press, because it's very easy to offer alternatives to media channels that you don't like. And that easily could become a tool for greater segmentation and fragmentation in a bad way. It easily can also become a tool for a greater diversity of viewpoints and a greater diversity of subjects argued about. So I think the media are an instrument, and what you choose to do with them doesn't have to be defined by the structure of the instruments available, at least not entirely.
Michael, you wanted to comment?
Yeah, I was just going to say one thing, which I actually think is an extension of something that Yuval is talking about in his book, which is the idea of relationality. Okay, so we can think about organizations as having, this is in response to you and you, in terms of who decides, right? I mean, we think of organizations as having a purpose that's defined by an issue. Well, that's how things get defined in politics, but that's not how organizations work when they're organized around relationships, right? When they're organized around relationships, the solidarity comes from the relationship, not sharing the issue. And, you know, effective civic organizations, effective mediating organizations, I think this is very much what Tocqueville had in mind. Organizations that had their solidarity built on their relationships, not on their issues. Now, the problem is that most civil society these days is instrumentalized. That is, it's organized around issues, and it's organized around issues in the pursuit of money. But there are organizations that are actually built on relationality. Citizens UK here in the UK is one of these, right? And the same thing actually goes for media. So organizations are concerned about media when they're concerned with their public image, and they're concerned with their public image because they're trying to draw on supporters around an issue, or they're trying to get money. But if their power comes from their relationships, they're not that concerned with the media. So I worked for an organization once, a community organizing group, and they were militant about never having a website. They were militant about never having a Twitter feed, and God, never, you should never be caught looking at Twitter. Because who cares? None of it has anything to do with power, and none of it has anything to do with how you build relationships. And it, you know, if it's the kind of deep relationality that you're advocating, I think that that gives much more power to the kind of civic renewal that, that you're advocating.
Cheryl? No. So there was a hand right down here in the front. I'll come to the back in a second. This gentleman right up here.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to try and sort of tackle a kind of conceptual confusion, which I think might sort of sit here, or at least something that I feel is a bit of a conceptual confusion. So my first issue is with Yuval's notion of nationalism and the role that it plays, certainly in the sort of Rust Belt and the these working class concerns. Now, it seems to me as if you're appealing to nationalism as if it's the goal of these various concerns which these people have. The Rust Belt, the reason that they're aiming for, the goal that they have in all of this political action is to reach a certain nationalism. But that seems to me slightly to get the things backwards. I mean, these people see nationalism as a solution to the problem. We lack jobs. Well, what do? We close the gates. We make sure that we drive everyone out of it. Nationalism is a solution which aims to solve problems for these people. So it seems like a sort of an opportunistic hanger-on on the back of their real concerns. Another question, and this is something which, sorry, just sort of a small point. I'll try keeping.
I got a lot
quick.
Of people who want to get in.
Yeah, but it's on the notion of solidarity, which pretty much everyone has been sort of attaching onto, and it seems to me as if kind of the notion of solidarity is incomplete. So. The appeal of solidarity, certainly to the left, is the appeal that solidarity turns around and says that the problems of someone else are not unsolvable or not inconceivable. Right? The reason why the left can appeal to sort of notions of solidarity is that we see other people as being, their problems as being ones that we can understand and grasp and engage with. And that's very different from the notion of solidarity which you seem to be appealing to and which leads to the kind of decentralized solutions which you're looking for, which say what we need are impersonal institutions and impersonal institutional structures to solve problems of solidarity, whereas we can't rely on our just fundamental knowledge of other people.
Okay. The gentleman right to your right. Right there.
Hey, I'm just wondering if effectively isn't what's demanded is a new social contract between basically the government and the people. So the American dream was the social contract, which was based on two foundations, if I think about it. One is everyone becoming the ability to become rich if you work hard, and it's a relative rich, so buying a house in suburbia or becoming better than from the country you immigrated for. And the second one is freedom of speech and democracy, which it seems President Trump is taking a name at, was hitting at freedom of expression in the press. So what is the new social contract that the American people is looking for is maybe, and how do you think about it?
Thank you. I was wondering if you could comment on the economic implications of the subsidiarity decentralization idea, especially in the context of increasing income inequality in the U.S. And decreasing social mobility.
We got like 10 minutes, 11 minutes to work with here, so we'll do this round and we'll try to do one more round. Okay.
All right. Not simple questions. Well, so to the first one, I think we largely agree. I certainly also suggested that nationalism is a means, not an end. I think that's quite right. Maybe we don't have the same end in mind, but actually maybe we do. As far as solidarity, I agree with that too, and it raises a question of scale. I mean, it does seem to me that the ideal of national solidarity in a country the level in a society that is the size and scope of the Americans is going to be a challenge, and that solidarity can be made a little easier by bringing some questions where it's possible to an interpersonal level, to a level where it's easier to understand one another. Again, it can't work in every instance, but I do think that it's a better path toward a sustainable solidarity. A social contract, so my book certainly tries to get at that idea. It's the subtitle of the book promises falsely that it will address itself that way. And speaking about the social contract, that's what the subtitle does. It makes false promises. That's the nature of the subtitle as a genre. I don't think I can say whether the American public as a whole has a new social contract in mind. I think the situation is probably a smaller scale than that. I would also say, as a general matter, and in response to some of the earlier questions too, that we've got to keep in mind that this past election was a very close election. It was not a marker of dramatic, all-encompassing social change. The American electorate did not look that different in 2016 than it did in 2012. Donald Trump lost the popular vote and barely won the electoral vote by winning very narrow majorities in a few places. The questions that were relevant a year ago are still very relevant. They're still the same questions. The challenges that the two parties in America and that the country in general faced are still the challenges. I do think it would be a mistake to see everything from now on through the prism of what Donald Trump has to say. That's not quite right. That would be to ignore a lot of what, in fact, are some of the largest challenges the country faces, but also to exaggerate others. And the economic implications, you know, it's a very hard question that the book certainly tries to get at. But it does seem to me that at getting to some of the ways that both social welfare policy could be more helpful on that front and that the way we think about how people get skills might work better might be improved by thinking about how the authority to do that and the resources to do that could flow a little more to institutions that are closer to the ground. But that's a very general answer, and I would just say buy the book and we'll both be happier.
Yeah. At least
Cheryl,
I will.
Yeah. Cheryl, go ahead.
So I'll just extend a little bit. I don't have an answer necessarily for you, but on the income inequality question. Actually, I think that this is quite fundamental. And when thinking about, you know, identifying the, what is the problem, what is the problem that we're looking at, and I come back to the issue of globalization and possibly some of the knock-on effects of that for income and wealth inequality, but not entirely. One thing that I'll just add to this is that you've noted it in the book, and you talk about it in a kind of a passing way, end of the Cold War as a, you know, as a real milepost in American history. Gromyko, I think there was a famous quote by Andrei Gromyko, who was the Soviet foreign minister, and he had said at one point, sort of toward the end of the Cold War, that the Soviet Union at the time, was going to do a terrible thing to the United States. It was going to deprive the U.S. of an enemy. Now, being deprived of an enemy means that that common focus, that little glue that unifies people, is lost, which allows all sorts of other disagreements and divides to percolate to the surface. Now, so I think that's part of what is going on. And we think about who's the enemy. And one feature that I'll mention, and I don't know where this is going, but I've got a third-year student who's who's analyzing, using text analysis, the speeches up to the nomination of Donald Trump versus those of Sanders, as sort of looking at what's the rhetoric of right-wing populism as opposed to left-wing populism. One of his initial findings is quite intriguing in terms of thinking who the enemy is. So for Donald Trump, the enemy, quite clearly, is foreigners. So it's Mexicans, it's the Chinese, right? It's the foreigners. For Sanders, the enemy was to be found within. It's the income inequality. The enemy is within our society. It's the haves and the have-nots. So one feature, I think, as I said, I don't have an answer on the income inequality, is to think about what the question is. Are we thinking about income inequality as being the problem that we're trying to solve, or is it something else? And who's the enemy? Who's at fault?
Okay, we're going to take one last round of questions. We'll take this gentleman right back there, and then I'll come over to the other side. One second. Guy with the hat.
Hello.
You get the hat, you get to ask a question with the hat. So go ahead.
So my question's addressed to Dr. Levine. So I take it for granted that you've read National Review's latest cover story about nationalism. And I was wondering which parts of Rich Lowry and Ramesh Panuru's article would you appropriate for the right, and what would you recommend for the left to appropriate in terms of nationalism? So one of the suggestions was, I think, immigration restrictionism. Anyway, thank you.
Hi, Brian Ramirez. I'm visiting graduate student here at the LLC. So I'm very curious as to... I'm very curious as to gerrymandering and voter suppression. We have not brought this up yet. What would you suggest our generation do to help solve the issues of gerrymandering and voter suppression, these really systematic issues that are causing us to not have truly represented a represented democracy? Thanks.
And one last question here. Go ahead.
I think he actually just asked my question because I was.
Okay, well then I'll take this gentleman right in the front here. That does happen from time to time.
Hello. This is kind of to everyone, but I really, Professor Bailey, liked your point about this imagined home. And I kind of wanted to get all three of your opinion on this. Is that sense of responsibility and collectivity not supposed to be liberalism, as in the small LJS Mill liberalism? Is, you know, as you can probably tell, I'm Australian, but I feel really at home in the UK. I've lived in the States, felt really at home there as well, because there's a shared principle in that JS Mill sort of liberalism that I feel like it's all part of the same community. And I grant that globalization is definitely an issue and there has been some inequality in that, but I feel both parties have sort of become illiberal in the way that they discuss issues. So as you kind of rightly point out, Donald Trump's party, the Republicans and Donald Trump, but mostly just Donald Trump really, have become this union, a call for such great unity that it promotes discrimination because you have to all be the same sort of union. And then the left has gotten so, their moral relativism is so lost that because they try to be so plural, there is absolutely no identity there. So everyone just starts thinking about one issue, which then results in identity politics. But both sides are just as liberal as each other. You know, left-wing Berkeley people saying Milo can't speak there. Trump saying the media can't speak there.
Mm. Okay.
Anyway, thanks.
So we'll leave it there. So Yuval, what I'm going to do is let you maybe respond to those first two questions, and do you want to? And then we'll just go down the line here on the last question, and that'll bring us over.
Okay. Well, so to the first, my friends at National Review will be very happy to hear that I got a question in London about their symposium on nationalism. I participated in it myself, so I wrote a response to their to that cover story in National Review, the kind of flagship conservative magazine in America. So I would only say that I agreed with the editor only to a very limited degree, and I think that the friendliness they showed to the approach that Trump takes to nationalism seems to me to be more a mistake than a helpful addition to the kind of vocabulary of conservatism. I think Trump's nationalism is not a very American nationalism, and I'll leave it at that. But I wrote about it at some length, so I'm happy to direct you to that if you're interested. I think gerrymandering and voter suppression are two very different things. I am not impressed that gerrymandering has done much damage, in fact. I think that the House of Representatives, where gerrymandering really matters, wouldn't look all that different without any gerrymandering than it does today. And so it seems to me that the geographic polarization of the American populace, the ideologically driven, in part culturally driven polarization, is reflected in our politics. This is good and bad. It helps Republicans and hurts Democrats in congressional elections and vice versa in presidential ones. But I don't think it's really a function of gerrymandering. Voter suppression obviously is a problem, and I do think that there's a tendency among some in Republican politics in America to talk about voter fraud to a degree that's just not supported by the evidence. And, this isn't only Trump, though he certainly did it to a degree that's not even related to anything that could be called evidence. So I'm just on the other side of that. I mean, I don't think that the voter ID stuff, I mean, look, at some level it makes sense logically that you should have to show identification to vote, but there's a history in America, especially a racial history, of that kind of thing being used in ways that are not about voting, and it's just not a good idea to bring it back. The benefit you might gain from it is just not even close to the damage it does to any attempt to speak frankly and in an open way with the broader population. So,
okay.
I don't know how much time.
Any final thoughts, comments?
About liberalism?
If you want, or on anything. Well, remote, related.
I mean, on the liberalism issue, I would just say that, you know, liberalism, first of all, has many meanings. But more importantly, you know, one of the main criticisms of liberalism all along has been that it gives an inadequate grounding for social solidarity, that it is alienating and individualizing and so on. And this is a core critique from the 19th century. And, you know, it's useful to keep that in mind. It's not adequate by itself. Now, what liberalism means to Americans today isn't that kind of liberalism. That is something entirely different. So it entails lots of governmental intervention, for example, to deal with these problems, which Yuval's critical of, and so on like that. And that's a different kind of liberalism altogether. And you know, it can deal, for example, with things like income inequality relatively well. It's also, for example, allowed for a real celebration of difference over and above any other value in a lot of circles, and that's probably destructive to social solidarity as well. I think we're seeing a reaction to that kind of liberalism. It's a very specific type, and it's very American in this moment.
I know we're out of time, and my answer would be longer, so I'm not sure if I want to try people's patience.
Okay, well,
you can
go ahead.
Oh, what the hell. Okay, so you can always get up and leave. Nobody's chaining you to your seats. All right, so, I mean, your answer actually was a far more elegant answer to the question of liberalism, whether this notion of sort of home and so on fits, where did that fit on the ideological spectrum. So one thing that I was thinking, and this harkens back to a little bit, you're saying about sort of 19th century, in part, there is when I think about this notion of home, the obligation, the responsibility, the shared responsibility, there is this long history. If you know anything about sort of Jeffersonian America, there is this tradition of kind of the rural America ethos and the small communities coming together and helping one another. And in fact, the whole, oddly enough, the term log rolling, which is key to congressional politics, comes from that notion of sort of the Wild West community spirit of people coming together as communities, building log cabins. So the new guy comes in with his family, and everyone 20 miles around, 40 miles around, joins up, drops everything, helps build a cabin, log cabin, right? And then the expectation, the obligation, is that the next family that comes in, this new guy, is going to drop everything and go help. Okay, it's a trading favors. It's that sort of ethos of obligation and shared responsibility. That's a long history, and oddly enough, it's part of one of the key terms of congressional politics, strange as that may seem, by the sharing of responsibility, sharing of favors. So when you're talking about this notion of obligation, it permeates, I think, a lot of dimensions of American politics, not only ideologically, but also its institutions, as dysfunctional as they might be, contemporary politics.
So I had only one job, which was to manage the time, and I screwed up. But I want to thank all of you for terrific questions and for being here this evening. I know I didn't get to everyone. Feel free to come up and ask questions afterwards, but please join me in thanking Yuval. Sure.